Welcome to Off the Frame, part two of the Grand Slam. It's 1970, and another chapter is about to be written.
49. Well, here we go. This is it. Match point to give Margaret a Grand Slam. Also a chance to win the Triple Crown here. She's still in all three events. She's won the women's doubles. Here we go.
Margaret Smith Court, Perth, Australia, has won the Grand Slam. 6-2, 2-6.
The year was 1970. It was a very good year. It was a very good year for a woman called Margaret Smith Court. Buzz, I'm singing that opening for a reason.
I really hope so. Really.
Now, look, I want to sing the praises of Margaret Court here. And I know she's a controversial figure, but I have to say her Grand Slam of 1970 was possibly the most courageous from a physical point of view out of all of them.
And it's good to talk about it now. We're coming up to the 50th anniversary this month. It was an incredible achievement. You think the year before, Rod Laver, another Australian, had won the Grand Slam on the men's side. And here comes Margaret Court. Now, you're saying that this was an incredible physical achievement. Why?
Essentially, she came through a series of injuries, physical injuries, that should have laid her low, should have stopped her in her tracks.
And she's undervalued, underrated. I think there's a distinct move for her to be downgraded because some of her Grand Slams were achieved in the amateur era.
Yep.
But when you look at her record...
Oh.
And what she missed as well. She had four children.
She did.
It's an incredible record.
It is incredible.
Yeah.
And the numbers alone. We're not about rattling off too many numbers, but some of these numbers really speak for themselves.
Astonishing. Even in the amateur era, for example, the Australian Open, people say, well, who was she beating? She did beat some people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, Maria Bueno in the final one. And Maria Bueno was a tennis player, great tennis player. And yes, the fields then weren't as strong as they were in the professional era and later.
Sure.
But the records and the numbers speak for themselves, pre and post the professional era kicking off.
Yeah, well, besides her 24 individual majors.
Which is a record as we record.
Yes.
Maybe tied this Grand Slam coming up.
Yes, she's also won in total 64 Grand Slam titles.
So that's singles, doubles and mixed doubles?
Yes. Four times, she's won three of the four slams. In addition to her Grand Slam in a calendar year.
Wow.
And 11 years apart, if I've got my numbers right there, 62 and 73.
She did three of the four in 1973.
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
That was pretty much her swan song year.
Yep.
They are amazing figures. But let's get back onto Court and this 1970 Slam.
So let's, for the record, let's see who she defeated. In the Australian, she defeated Kerry Melville, another Aussie. The French, she defeated Helga Nielsen. At Wimbledon, and this is the most famous of all these matches, and one of the most famous women's matches ever played, I would say, to be up there.
It's still rated.
Against Billie Jean King, who she had a pretty superior record against.
Definitely.
She won 14-12, 11-9. These are the years before tiebreakers.
Mm.
One of the longest matches ever, I believe.
Yes.
Then at the US, to win the Grand Slam, she defeated Rosie Casals. It's not Rosemary, is it? In three. And now that was a trial for her.
Yeah. Let's just visit some of these moments that could have derailed her slam.
Sure.
At the French Open, second round, which she could easily have lost, played a girl called Olga Morozova. Cramps in her calf, which develops into a blood clot. I mean, I couldn't imagine even eating dinner with a blood clot, let alone playing a tennis match. Could you?
No, I can't see it, but thanks for the visual imagery there.
So there was that.
But that wasn't the final.
No.
So she played the tournament with this blood clot problem and won it.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. So she got through that and then made her way. And this is on clay where on grass, okay, maybe you can...
Shorten the points.
Shorten the points, but on clay from that point onward.
Jeez.
Thing was, though, she, for some reason, and I don't know why, she'd earmarked 1970 as her last genuine shot. In her mind, she thought, this is my last chance. So that was uppermost in her mind, I think, was driving some of her decisions to keep playing through the pain barrier. So Wimbledon, before that classic final with Billie Jean, she meets up against Helga Nielsen, who she beat in the French.
Mm.
She plays her in the fourth round. Now she twists her left ankle.
Can I just ask, is there any possibility that Margaret Court was just really clumsy?
Well, she was gangly. She was tall. Remember, her arms were 3 inches longer than an average woman's.
Isn't that incredible stat?
That's a stat. Yeah. So perhaps that could have come into play.
A wingspan.
Mighty wingspan at the net.
Yeah. And she was tall anyway.
But she loses that set and she decides, if I don't start blasting away here, this game's over. So she does that and she wins 6-love, 6-love. It's one thing to be able to say, I'm just going to go for winners, but to execute it. Yeah. And in her mind, her Grand Slam's riding on this, and she does so. Now, she torn ligaments in her ankles. I've never torn ligaments. Have you?
I've seen someone. My brother tore his ligament, and that wasn't pretty to watch. He was in agony.
Can you get him on the line so we can then talk to him?
He's still screaming.
Get a description of what it feels like. Very painful. So she tears ligaments in her ankle. Now, for the next few days, she's treating like crazy because it's imperative that she gets on court, even though doctor's advice is, don't do it, Margaret. You're crazy, Margaret. But Margaret didn't listen.
That was Dr. Jean King.
Dr. Jean King, could have been. Anyway, she gets on to her next match against Rosie Casals with pain-killing needles.
Rosie Casals came onto the court with pain-killing needles?
No, Margaret Court. Well, no, I don't think you think Rosemary Casals brought them on for Margaret and then injected them into her ankle.
I'm not sure.
No, I think the doctor did.
Okay.
And here's an interesting point. Those needles are going to wear off. I think they would last for 2 hours. So she had a fixed time frame to get this match done with.
Wow.
And she refuses to have a hit up at the beginning. You know when they always have a hit up at the beginning of a match?
Yeah.
So Margaret says, I don't want the hit up.
And what does Rosie Casals say?
Well, this is the question. I believe that it's not mandatory, but if one person wants the hit up and another person doesn't, what happens? Is it the higher ranked player who gets the say in it, or does the umpire flip a coin? It's an interesting one. Maybe we can delve into that another time.
Or, is it just the person who doesn't want it gets their way?
Well, this is it. I thought, well, I've never seen that happen before. It's interesting, though.
You'd think she did it only for time's sake?
Oh, yeah. It was just...
Because otherwise you could just get out there and bat the ball away and not do anything, you know, if you don't
have
a warm-up.
Well, it was. It was just to get into it straight away. But I just think it's an interesting thing. I mean, Rosemary Casals probably there with her mouth open going, well, where's the hit-up?
Yeah. Maybe Rosie Casals came and said, well, I don't want to play the match. And they said, we're going to forfeit, Rosie. She said, okay, I'll play the match.
Yeah, she hadn't worked it through.
No, hadn't thought it through at all.
But I know a lot of people in the audience were very disappointed that they missed out on a hit-up before the match because some people enjoy that part of
the game.
That's
what they go for.
Anyway. I thought that was an interesting little side issue there. So she gets through, beats Casals. Then the big final against Billie Jean King.
Yep.
Okay. Seven pain-killing injections to get on the court. Imagine being Margaret Court's doctor. You keep giving her advice, she keeps ignoring you. How do you think that person feels?
And then you have to give her pain-killing injections.
Yeah, probably with a little bit more gusto.
You want to be careful. You don't want to hit anything you don't want to hit.
Yep. So seven to get on the court. And then a match that goes for about 2 hours.
Wow.
Even though Billie Jean King also damaged her ankle, I believe. So she was playing injured too, so was Court. And I've watched recently some of that match, and you can see on Court's face.
The pain?
Oh, yeah. It's interesting. Once you know what's happening behind the scenes, and then you look at it again, you see it differently. And you can see she's really struggling.
So there was guts involved in this.
And she wins that match. But if that match had gone for a third set, wouldn't have made it.
And she won that set 11-9, second set.
Held on. So there is some determination here. And again, because she was positive that this was her last chance at winning.
She was going to leave it all out there.
Yeah.
All right.
So she gets off the court. I think the doctor tells her, you have to rest this for 3 months. Guess what? The US Open is in 2 months.
Damn.
Now, do you think Margaret's going to listen to a doctor?
No, she never listens to a doctor.
I don't know why she just didn't fire the guy.
I don't know why he didn't quit.
Why keep humiliating this medical professional?
Every time he just sort of throw his arms up and storm out of the room. I must have got sick of doing that.
Imagine him saying, okay, Margaret, here's my professional advice. I'm going to tell you what to do, and then I want you to do the opposite. Are we agreed? She'd play along and say, yeah, sure, Doc. I don't know how it would have played out.
But... Well, maybe he just got so sick of her ignoring his advice that he'd say, Margaret, this is what I want you to do. And walk out.
Do what you want.
Do what you want.
Do whatever you want.
Yeah, it's your grand slam, not mine.
She gets back on court, though, sooner than expected. Rehabs, trains, ends up playing, I think, 4 tournaments before the US Open. That's how quickly she recovered. Now, get this. The day before the US Open, she's practicing. You know what she does? She twists her ankle the day before the US Open starts.
Same ankle?
Same ankle. Can you believe that?
I'm starting to believe it.
It's a story, isn't it?
I'd be surprised if she didn't.
Did you know all this was going on behind the scenes during 1970 in that slam? It's a doozy.
Oh, no. I wasn't watching
that. Okay. But you know, you would just read the record books and go, 1970, Margaret.
Exactly. Cool. Wins the Grand Slam.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Better than not bad. She does her ankle again. And guess what? The advice is...
Go out there and give your all. No, that's not the advice. Get off the court. She said, don't be an idiot.
No more painkilling injections, Margaret. Because if you have any more painkilling injections, you could do permanent damage, not only to your ankle, but to your leg. That was the advice. You know what she did?
She heeded the advice. Why are you asking me? I know what happened.
Okay, well, I'm just trying to create a sense of drama here.
Sorry. Okay, go on.
Where's Charlton Heston when you need him? Ignores the advice, needles up again, and wins that US Open. But you know what a lucky break was? We're talking about luck. Billie Jean King withdrew from the US Open to have surgery. Somebody who does listen to the advice of medical professionals.
Right.
And that, I believe, was her lucky break. I think a fully fit Billie Jean King would have been able to take advantage. I think so.
Wow.
And that was her lucky break, my friend.
And so she weathered the storm of pain and discomfort and against the doctors. And then finally, after everything going against her, she gets that one lucky break.
Mm.
However, in the final,
didn't
it flare up again in the final against Rosie Casals?
Yeah, the pain flared up, but it must have been manageable. The crowd was going nuts because they were cheering on an American.
And she'd lost the second set, so it was one set all.
Yep.
Right.
And that point, it would have been very easy just to think, look, I've given it my best. She settles herself. Calms herself, wins that last set, achieves her dream.
So here's a question. When she gets back to Australia, marching bands, is the Harbour Bridge lit up in whatever, in streamers? I don't know what they did in those days.
Nothing. She got more attention when she won her first Wimbledon because she was the first Australian woman to win Wimbledon. And that was treated with a lot more fanfare. This is the Grand Slam. Nothing.
So it just shows you, you know, how it's treated, even though Rod Laver had won it the year before.
Yeah, but maybe people start to think, oh, Laver won it in 69, Cole won it in 70, what's the big deal? Newcomb will win it next year.
Yeah, true. Maybe it was familiarity breeds contempt.
Well, it could have been, but she was very flat. She felt very flat.
Afterwards.
Like, is that all there is? It seems to be a common thing when you achieve. But I'll tell you what, she kept playing for 3 years afterwards at a very high peak. So I think her doctor didn't know what he was talking about.
I don't think you ought to be doing this to yourself, Andy.
I guess it comes down to a simple choice, really. Get busy living, or get busy dying.
Remo, as we've seen, Margaret Court wins the 1970 Grand Slam on the women's side.
Mm-hmm.
And surprisingly, for the next decade, maybe decade and a half, it's a tumultuous time in the history of the Grand Slam. It starts to wither on the vine. And the reason is because the Australian and the French are in trouble.
They're in big trouble. Buzz, can I just say something? I went to the trouble of starting that last section singing. And I'm a little disappointed that that was all you could come up with.
You want me to come up with something?
Well.
Hey, hit it.
But yeah, you're right. Grand Slam tennis was in big trouble. It's basically the US and Wimbledon. That's what everyone cared about in terms of prestigious titles. Now, what was it with the French and the Australian? Like, what happened there? The French was seen as a bit of an outlier-type tournament, specifically for the dirt rats.
Yeah, the Australian itself was really poorly organised.
Yeah.
Long way to come.
Mm.
And was just seen as being a little provincial, I think.
Can I tell you a story about the 69 Australian Open, the year Labor wins his slam? The officials for the 69 Australian Open were so lukewarm about hosting the Australian as an open tournament. These are the amateur officials who are still bearing grudges about the end of amateurism, they didn't do proper seedings for that tournament. So you had players from 1 to 8, I kid you not, playing each other in the first two rounds of the tournament.
You serious?
I am serious. And this is something Rod Laver has never forgiven the organisers of that Australian Open.
That's unbelievable. Yeah, no wonder people, you know, players were turning against it.
Well, no wonder. And here's another story. I wasn't going to say this, but it's just come into my head. This gives you an idea. When Margaret Court Smith won her first Australian Open, I think it was 1960.
Right, still in the amateur years.
She would have got some silverware. What they used to do is also supplement that with another prize. Do you know what she got in 1960 to go along with the silverware?
No.
An umbrella. So I can imagine these officials there saying, well, we have to give Margaret something else. Oh, look, I think I got something in the back of my car. I'll see what I got in the boot. And he pulls out some umbrella or something. Give her this.
An umbrella.
And that's a true story. The next year, you know what she got? An empty makeup kit with a loose mirror rolling around inside it. Could you imagine that today?
They were obviously very careful because it's the amateur years and they couldn't give them anything that would make them look professional.
No.
So they gave them something that looked really unprofessional.
I wonder if Margaret Court still has that umbrella.
Well, I hope she does. And that makeup kit.
I would ask her the question, Margaret, whatever happened to that umbrella? It's probably ended up in an official's, no, I won't say. But anyway, sorry, I've taken us off track there. But yeah, we're talking about the decline of the Grand Slam now.
Now, the interesting part of this is that tennis itself started to take off.
Yeah.
So the early 70s, and we'll be talking about this in other podcasts, but there was a famous Laver-Rosal match.
Yes.
On American television. It played at the same time as the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. And people were switching over. And people say it was a seminal moment in tennis history. But not only that, a lot of international players started to come into the sport. It became a far more international sport than it was before. So the interest was starting to peak and grow at the same time as the Australian Open was dying and the French wasn't considered up there.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the next big thing that happened with the Grand Slam was a young Swedish man, Bjorn Borg.
Indirectly, yes.
Yes. He starts winning multiples of majors, which hadn't been done for a long time, really. I mean, Margaret Court had, but we're talking professional era.
Yeah.
So he won 5 Wimbledon in a row and he won 6 French Open titles.
Mm.
He was amassing numbers here.
That's right. So people starting to delve back into the record books and saying, oh, hang on, when was the last time somebody had won Wimbledon 3 times in a row?
Which was Fred Perry.
That's right. And the interest started to build. And before Borg, remember 2 Connors came through. Brash almost demanded attention.
Absolutely.
So he came through, broke through the barrier. Then you had this very charismatic Swedish player, long blonde hair, very handsome, almost became a rock god. So things started to turn and tennis became very popular. But it was only becoming popular because of these different elements, these more modern type elements. So the Grand Slams were almost something from a bygone era. Until Borg started winning successive titles and people started thinking, well, hang on, he's winning the French and Wimbledon. This is a guy who could possibly go on
and do it all.
And do it all.
And remember, in this day and age, the number of majors that people win is held up high. In those days, it wasn't really. It wasn't considered to be that important.
No.
And Borg always thought he wanted to win the Grand Slam.
He
said that. He wanted to win it. And so, therefore, the importance of that and the emphasis on that. Now, tying into this is the Australian Open itself. The Australians and the Australian Open are really crucial in the history of the Grand Slam.
Somewhat inadvertently, in a way, thanks to the fact that they won that Davis Cup way back in 1907, they become one of the 4 major championships. The other key thing is the tournament started in January. You had to come to Australia if you wanted to win the Grand Slam. Crawford, an Australian, nearly does it in 33. Hoad, an Australian in 56, nearly does it. Maureen Connolly, who we've spoken about, in 1953, comes under the tutelage of Mel Hopman and, of course,
Harry Hopman.
Through that year, there's an Australian involved. Laver, 62, 69. Margaret Court, 1970. So, really, Australians are up to their neck in the Grand Slam. But, ironically, the tournament that should be kicking it off was fading and fading fast.
And so what did they do? They tried something quite radical.
Yeah.
They took it from the start of the year
Yep.
and put it to the end of the year.
Now, what happened in 1977?
In order to do that, they played the Australian Open in January.
Yeah.
And then played it again
in December.
Which just seems really, really odd to do. Why didn't they wait for the following year? I've never understood that.
Yeah.
So actually, in 1977, you had two chances to win the Grand Slam.
Yes, you could definitely look at it. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah.
Or you could have won five Grand Slam tournaments. What would that have been called?
The Five Slam. You know, what the hell was that?
They were lucky, you know.
Oh.
They were very lucky. But
exactly.
It's a wonderful bit of administrative incompetence that I think needs to be acknowledged.
Now, one of the things, obviously, having the Australians the last Grand Slam.
Yeah.
Was that if someone won the first three, they would be forced, not forced, but in their own mind, they would want to come to Australia desperately to win the Grand Slam. Bjorn Borg won French and Wimbledon 3 years straight, that incredibly difficult double to win. And so he always went to the US Open in those years thinking, if I win this, I'm going to Australia to play for the Grand Slam. So 1980... he loses to John McEnroe in the fifth set of US Open. That would have been a turning point, I think, if he'd been able to come in and actually play for it. But it was still in the consciousness.
Yes.
Players were not coming down to the Grand Slam.
No.
Until it started to happen a little bit in the 80s.
It started to turn with the women's event.
That's right.
Women's event in the early 80s started to get its act together. They started to come down and the men's were still lagging. But that's what initially started to kick it. And they separated, remember? They separated the event from the men's.
Right.
So they went their own way. That was the fillip that the whole thing needed to get it moving again.
A huge decision was made.
The end of 85.
So they built the arena at Flinders Park in Melbourne. Now, that was a huge decision because there were rumours that the Australian Open could have been taken away from Australia if they didn't get their act together. So they bit the bullet in Melbourne and said, right, we're going to do it. And they built that amazing stadium, which today is almost a favourite of the players, the way they're treated. And it's really turned it around.
I've got to stop you there because I've got to ask you a question. It's all to do with what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Who won the Australian Open in 1986?
That would have been Herbie Flam.
He wishes. Nobody.
Nobody. So, right, in 77 they played two. In 86, to the divine wisdom of the Australian Open organisers, they didn't play one.
But they had to make that call in the sense that...
because they were playing in January of 87.
That's right. They'd finished playing it in December 85, so they couldn't play it again in January 86, although it probably crossed their minds.
Yes. I wonder if the organisers of the Australian Open went to church every day and knelt and just prayed that no one was going to win the first three. Can you imagine if you won the three that year?
I know.
Would they have given you the Grand Slam if you won the Australian the next year?
They were very lucky that the things panned out the way they did, but it was breathtaking in its incompetence.
And its audacity.
But it got sorted. It got sorted, thankfully.
And so, therefore, the Grand Slam was rejuvenated. I mean, the French had been rejuvenated somewhat because, I don't think it was because of Bjorn Borg, but they'd done enough to get interest back into it.
Yeah, pretty sure it was Chatrier who came on board there and turned the corner with that. I could be wrong, but they just upped the facilities and they brought some prestige back to it.
In some ways, it was easier for the Australians to do it because, you know, they don't have the history or whatever, the French.
I'll go back to saying we just had French people playing this tournament.
Yes.
We don't need you.
Yeah.
But they didn't.
Was that almost getting into a French? Were you trying to do something?
I don't do accents. I can sing if you like.
Do an accent.
But anyway, Borg, as you said, never wins the US Open. Australian Open in 1987 is moved back to the beginning of the year. And 1 year later, finally, a drought is broken. And a young lady from Germany wins the Grand Slam.
Here we are. Grand Slam point.
And history. So Steffi Graf has won the Grand Slam.
As I'm sure you're aware, we have witnessed tennis history today. For only the third time has a lady won the Grand Slam. And Steffi Graf has done that today. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States Tennis Association, Mr. Gordon Jorgensen, has a special present for Steffi Graf. Gordon?
Thank you. Steffi, what a special occasion this is. You have to know how all of us here are proud of you and your accomplishments. And in this regard, as starters, we want to give you this gold bracelet that has four diamonds symbolizing your conquest of the four Grand Slams. Congratulations.
And ladies and gentlemen, before we speak with Steffi, we'd like to introduce a gentleman that 50 years ago was the first to ever win the Grand Slam, J. Donald Budge. Don?
So there we have it. In 1988, Steffi Graf wins the Grand Slam. Now, Remo, did you notice anything about that audio that stuck out to you in terms of the history of the Grand Slam?
To my ears, it sounded like finally we have on the big stage due recognition of what this achievement fully means. They commemorate it with, I think she gets given a piece of jewelry with four emeralds or diamonds, whatever, but it's given its full due, finally.
Apparently, Graf said she wanted an umbrella, but they just couldn't spring for it. So, and who's on the podium with her? Who's presenting it to her? Mr. Don Budge.
Don Budge.
And it comes around full circle.
There. Nice touch. I mean, we gave the American authorities a bit of a serve earlier, but hats off to you there. Well done. Commemorating your great champion. But yeah, Don Budge was there and only fitting too.
Steffi Graf in 1988.
What a year.
What a year. I think there can be some parallels to the Maureen Connolly Grand Slam, I think, just in terms of her domination that year.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, she came out and she was demolishing women in the early rounds. They just did not know how to handle that forehand in particular.
Yeah.
I still think their forehand's the greatest shot in tennis history. That's my view. So dominant. They just didn't know what hit them. But the other thing about this Grand Slam that maybe differs from the others is that there's the level of competition she was facing.
Sure.
And the other thing, she played on different surfaces.
The only slam won, genuinely, on three different surfaces.
Having said that, do you think Graf in 88 was in a sweet spot in that she had come up, she'd taken the world by storm, Navratilova and Evert, she beat them in two finals.
Yeah, legends.
Were they on the downward hill? Did she get them just at the right point? Was there a sweet spot for this Grand Slam?
It's a hard one to answer, especially now, 2019, 2020. We've got a guy called Roger Federer who's inching up towards 39. Evert was a spring chicken of 31, 32.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I would have answered that before and said, yeah, definitely. But you look at Evert, she makes a fist of that final.
But do you think in those days, though, when players did get to that age, it was just a mindset of, well, I'm on my, you know, Graf retired at 30.
Yeah.
But let's have a look. I think in that year, she went 72-3. In other words, she won 72 matches, lost only three. One of the great years.
Oh, yeah.
Reached the final in 12 of the 14 tournaments she played.
Yep.
And she won 46 consecutive matches.
Yeah, she was hot.
Absolutely on fire. And who'd she beat? Who did she beat in that Grand Slam?
With the Australian, we mentioned her. She defeated Chris Evert at the French. Unfortunately for a poor lass called Natalie Zvereva. And I'm going to mention the score here. It was 6-love, 6-love. I don't know what the time was on that final.
It actually took 3 hours.
The rallies. Boy, the rallies. Wimbledon was next. Defeats the great Navratilova. Three sets at Wimbledon, basically on her home turf.
Who won 9 Wimbledons or what?
Yes. So, and in the US, I guess one of her rivals, Gabriella Sabatini, again, three sets, but ran home in that last set, like 6-3, 3-6. So it's set all.
Yeah.
Grand Slam's in the balance. She comes out 6-1, smokes Sabatini. 6-1.
6-1, yep.
Wonderful year, wonderful achievement. And she's playing this slam under the most intense media spotlight ever.
That's right. No one's ever faced that.
It would be worse now, but it was finally full on a big scale in 88, and she dealt with all of that. That's why I think there's a good case for saying that this is possibly the greatest single slam of all of them.
Adding to that, she won the Olympic gold medal. So she's the only one with the golden slam, as it's called.
That's right.
Who knows if that'll ever be done again?
No.
I have my doubts.
Mm.
Do you rate this higher than Laver's too?
I think it's hard to split. I'm thinking now about the 69. But yeah, I would.
Yeah, okay.
because of the things that we've mentioned. The pressure, the media spotlight, the different surfaces. Beat two legends, all-time legends in two of those finals.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I know Laver, you know, he was beating Newcomb and Roach as well, but I think on the balance, if I had to nominate one, I would nominate this. But as a set, Laver's two.
Hard to beat.
Very hard to beat.
Lawrence, only two kinds of creature get fun in the desert. Bedouins and gods, and you're neither. Take it from me. For ordinary men, it's a burning, fiery furnace.
So 1988, Steffi Graf wins the Grand Slam. Hasn't happened since. We're talking a period
31,
now.
31 years now, yeah.
The question is, firstly, why the drought?
Do you think it's harder to win a Grand Slam now than it's ever been?
Yes.
That's why then.
Well, it's the depth, isn't it?
It's the depth.
The equipment, all sorts of factors that are going into the sport that evens up the playing field, perhaps, in some ways.
But having said that, often a Grand Slam is won by someone. Think of Don Budge, think of Maureen Connolly, think of Steffi Graf, who are young, they hit their straps, bang, they win it straight off the bat. Okay. Why didn't Roger Federer win? Why didn't Serena Williams win when they were at their peak?
Looking at it now, Federer's chance was 2004.
Yeah.
That was his chance.
Yeah.
After that, now all bets are off.
I know you're going to argue with me. I would say the rise of Rafael Nadal was the reason he didn't win the Grand Slam. There's no question to me of that.
Sure.
And there you go. That happens. That happens to a lot of players. You know, without this player, that person would have won the Grand Slam.
Of course.
You have to be in the right place, the right time. Things have to fall your way.
Mm-hmm.
The question I have for you, before we get into the topic of this section, is it just destiny? Does it really earmark you as the greatest, or is it just a destiny thing that falls in your lap and others could have had it? I mean, I can think of five or six players who could have won a Grand Slam and didn't.
If the cards had fallen the right way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
Three of them are playing right now. Four of them are playing right now, including Serena.
A miracle at the Meadows, an upset for the ages. History is on hold, stunning everyone in the world except a young lady from Italy named Roberta Vinci against Serena, looking for the calendar slam and Serena taking advantage.
Well, we've just heard a bit of audio on Serena Williams, and that's 2015. So we've gone from 1988 and it's taken till 2015 before another genuine opportunity arose.
Where someone was playing the US Open to win the Grand Slam.
Yes, which is the key here.
Yes.
When you look at that match, the numbers leave you scratching your head big time.
So we're looking at Serena Williams entering the US Open as a hot favourite to take the US Open. And let's face it, in that year, she had opposition. And it's not meaning to cast aspersions on opposition, but it wasn't like other times in her career when she was up against hot players. It was a bit of a desert there. And what happens? She reaches the semi-final. She's playing Roberta Vinci of Italy, who she never lost a set to. She goes up a set to love. And then what happens, Remo? And I know you're shaking your head here because you still can't believe it.
I can't believe it. And I've watched highlights of that match recently. There's a great 10-minute highlight package. It's painful to watch, because there is no reason in the world why Serena Williams would lose to Roberta Vinci. Hey, I've got nothing against Roberta Vinci. I love watching her play.
Yeah.
Slice chases everything down. What happened? It was the weight of history.
It had to be.
Gone inside her head.
First or second round, she just rolls through that match and it's over.
She's a set away. She wins that first set. She's one set away.
Now, I read somewhere, and it hasn't been confirmed, that after she won the first set, in live betting odds, Roberta Vinci was 250-1. I don't know if that's even possible, but I've read that. And you think to yourself, okay, even if it's not true, if it was 20-1, it makes you realise that there's no way on earth she should have won it.
Well, there was no footage, was there, of Serena Williams calling a bookie and putting a bet on at that time? It's the only thing I can think of what may have happened. No, look, I'm being facetious there. That's crazy. Would you have put your hard earned on a 251 after that first set?
Well, you know that I'm a long odds better.
Actually, you would have been first in queue there, wouldn't you?
I'm a glory better from way back, yeah.
Now, I can't remember if Flavia Panetta, who won the US Open that year, had already made it to the final. I think she may have.
So she knew.
Williams is basically thinking,
I've got this in the bag.
I think it would be very hard not to have thought ahead.
Yeah.
Thought, this is my grand slam.
Yeah. Now, talking about thinking, the one thing that Roberta Vinci gave her was time to think, because Roberta Vinci didn't have weapons that we associate with power players. She just retrieved.
Yeah.
If she was a power player, Serena would have had less time to think, which may have been in her favour.
Yep.
She loses that match and is devastated. Apparently she didn't get out of bed for weeks.
Mm.
That was what they said. She was just devastated.
Oh, yeah. You look at the press conference and you can tell she's in denial about choking up on that match, and it's understandable. But you're right, though. If she was playing, say, someone like Kim Clijsters, would have been right in her wheelhouse.
Yep. Absolutely.
But it was the opponent who presented that day, probably with a game that was the last style of game that she would want to face.
That's right. Whereas any other time, it was easy peasy.
And she did it over in that first set. Yep. Business as usual. For all her denials, she let it get inside her head.
So no woman has ever come so close to the Grand Slam without winning it. Nope. Here's a question for you. She won the first three and then lost the US Open.
Yep.
The last person to do that, was that Lou Hode? In 1953, is that right?
56,
sorry.
So correct.
That's 49 years, almost since 50 years.
Again.
That's a long time.
Mm. And it's a long time even to have somebody after Graf in 88.
Yeah.
You know?
But she wasn't the last, Remo.
No.
Someone.
More recent.
And I think perhaps as incredibly.
In its own way.
Lost it. And we're talking about the great wheelchair tennis player, Dylan Alcott, the Australian, again.
Mm-hmm.
What a connection Australia has to this Grand Slam.
Yes.
Yeah, it's massive. So I got the opportunity to win the Grand Slam at the US Open, which I'm super excited about. So I've won three slams this year. If you get them all in 1 year, it's called a calendar Grand Slam, where Rod Laver territories. So if I could be only 1/10 as good as the legend Rod Laver was, I'll be happy. So it'd be amazing to do that. I can have all my friends and family there and things like that. So I am super, not nervous, excited. I'm really excited for the opportunity.
Essentially, again, Alcott goes into the US Open final, and this seems to be a recurring pattern, as the red-hot favourite. Everyone's thinking, this is it. Simply because the person who beats him in that final, a Brit called Andy Lapthorne, he had pretty much demolished at Wimbledon. The expectation is, well, you've got this guy's measure. But you know what happens? He loses to this guy. One and love. Wow. Now, if it had been 6-4, 7-5, you'd go, okay, the other guy's come to play and it's turned into a battle and things have developed. But that scoreline, there's something going on again. Yeah. And I think it's the same ghost that was haunting Serena.
Alcott is a really great wheelchair tennis player.
Yeah.
Number one in the world.
Yeah.
He was on a 23-match winning streak at that point. And we heard him talking about the Grand Slam. It was in his mind.
Mm.
And I think part of him was like he'd be the first wheelchair tennis player to win a Grand Slam and the first Australian since Margaret Court, and continuing that tradition. Now, that would have weighed heavily on his shoulders, I think.
You know, we've been talking about players who have nearly won the Grand Slam or who have won the Grand Slam. Common denominator there is they come in on these winning streaks, right?
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering now, today, if you would be better off not having a winning streak. If you were going to win the Grand Slam, having an awful lead up and you get hot in the slam and in between slams, you're a bit so-so. You're up and down. You don't come in with this pressure of having 30 on the trot. You know how it builds in itself?
Yeah.
You come into each slam having lost your last 42 matches. And you go, I'm free, you know, and you surprise everyone. And then go, wow, where did that come from? And then you start losing again.
And the losing gives you confidence because you're losing.
That's right. But we're talking about peaking. How long can you hold a peak for?
That's right.
Careful how you answer that.
At some point, you're going to fall.
I think so. That would be my strategy.
We're living in an age, we've got Serena in the women's who should have won a Grand Slam.
Yeah.
We've got three guys playing right this moment, all of whom could have won a Grand Slam. No question.
In their hearts, they would feel that.
I think the difference between Serena and the difference between the big three, we're talking about Federer, Djokovic and Nadal, is that they would be looking at each other saying, if it wasn't for you, buddy, I would be in that podcast. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
If Roger Federer, if you're listening, mate, we understand. Novak, Rafa, our hearts are with you. Oh. We understand that, and we're not downplaying your achievements by not including you as winners of the Grand Slam. We understand how hard it is. And that's part of the luck. That's part of the timing.
Mm.
I mean, this era we're living in is, in men's, is ridiculous. Obviously, we'll do podcasts on that as well at some point.
Yeah.
I can't see a Grand Slam happening until they retire.
Mm.
I wonder if when those three retire, there's going to be a window for someone.
Okay.
Do you know what I'm saying?
I do, but let me just tie it up now that you've introduced those three greats of all time. Out of the three, each of them was in a position to win the Grand Slam at that US Open. Out of those three, who do you think would handle that pressure the best? And I just want one answer, one word answer here.
That's a really, really good question. I have my doubts about Roger Federer in terms of his mental strength in that situation. My immediate inclination was to say Novak Djokovic, but he's shown some mental frailties before. That leaves Rafa Nadal, and I wouldn't bet on him in the US if he's playing one of those guys. So I don't know. Who would you?
I'm not going to answer the question. All I'm going to say is, what part of the word one don't you understand?
What is this?
A center for ants?
What? Derek, it's just a...
I don't want to hear your excuses. The center has to be at least 3 times bigger than this.
The Grand Slam, the pinnacle of tennis, Remo. But yeah, I know there's one thing that grates on you about the Grand Slam. One aspect of it that you just can't wrap your head around.
Yeah.
What is that?
Well, if we're going to call the Grand Slam the greatest feat in tennis, the pinnacle, the ultimate, surely it would have to be acknowledged in the form of some kind of trophy. There is nothing that exists by way of acknowledging Grand Slam winners, the Grand Slam I'm talking about here, of course. So I just think that that's outrageous.
Yeah, there's trophies for the Australian, French, Wimbledon and the US, obviously. Yeah. You've all seen photos of the great champions holding up.
Yes, the Davis trophies. Cup.
Davis Cup, exactly. Olympic gold medal.
Yep.
For tennis.
Something tangible.
Even a minor 250 tournaments.
That's right.
Trophies. They all do, of different shapes and sizes to commemorate the victor. You win the pinnacle of tennis. You win those four majors in 1 year. Mm. There is nothing.
No. Something hastily organised, as we heard with Steffi Graf. There's a bracelet organised there at the end of the day, because you have to acknowledge it. It's not just a handshake and an umbrella, for God's sake.
Exactly. Don't you think the tennis officials, the tennis body should
get
together?
The International Federation.
Wouldn't it be a great thing to say, here it is. Here is this trophy that you are playing for if you win the Grand Slam, and it has the names of the previous winners on it. Just let me put a counter argument to you.
Mm.
Do you think it would ever be enough? Every tournament has a trophy, and yet the Grand Slam just has a trophy. Shouldn't it be something a bit more grand?
Well, I hadn't considered that. Maybe I was thinking about it a little bit too narrowly, but you could be right there. Teddy, I believe, is going to join us in this part of the podcast because he's involved in this whole notion up to his neck, I believe.
He's always had an opinion on it.
Oh, yeah. He first alerted me to this anomaly. I didn't even think about it. How can a couple of schmoes like us be thinking about this and nobody in the officialdom of tennis has come up with a suggestion, say, oh, hang on, it's too obvious, isn't it?
Let's face it. Whatever we're thinking, Teddy has thought of before.
That's a worry.
That's a concern. Teddy's coming in now. He's coming in now. So, Teddy, welcome. Welcome back to the podcast.
And Teddy, this is your last time. I know that you've got places to be and people to see, and we thank you, but we really need you in this last section.
This is a topic close to my heart, and I have great experience with this, and I do have my opinions. And I think that with the Grand Slam, historically, there's been problems. For example, Don Budge wins the 1938 Grand Slam. What did they have for him? Nothing. And so what did they organise? Hastily organise is, well, there's Big Bill Tilden. Let's shoot him out of a cannon.
And Big Bill was up for that?
Well, Big Bill, I don't think he was in his right mind at that point. And Big Bill got into the cannon. I don't know what they told him to get in there. And they let the cannon off, and there goes Big Bill flying across the court and ended up in the third row and in the lap of, you know, a family from Philadelphia. But
what I thought was very interesting about that, Teddy, was that Big Bill actually brought the cannon along to the match.
Well, he always did in those days. He had a year where he brought cannons along, and no one was going to say no to Big Bill, were they? I mean, many people should have said no to Big Bill, but they never did. He was larger than life, wasn't he? He truly, truly was. And
I have to say, I know I was promulgating the idea of a trophy, but I'm coming around to the idea of shooting a tennis legend out of a cannon to commemorate. It's not too bad.
Teddy, who fired the cannon? Like, someone obviously had to. How was it fired? Was it like one of those, you know, those pull string things, or was it a fuse?
It was like a circus cannon.
A circus cannon.
One of those.
Well, no, not at all, actually. It was one of those ones where you actually had to light a wick, but the wick was about 15 feet long, and everyone was a little bit worried about what was about to happen. I thought he might actually blow a hole in the actual grandstand, but no. There goes Bill, flying through the air.
Couldn't keep the limelight off Tilden.
Oh, Tilden was a hog for the limelight, you know, and Budge was appalled, obviously. Don didn't like anyone stealing his limelight, and I saw him watch Tilden fly across the court, and his shadow flew across Don Budge, and he looked up and said, well, there's Tilden. I hope that's the last of him. I think he was disappointed he didn't leave the stadium with that firing.
Well, yeah, that was 1938. Now, I know Little Mo won it in 53, and again, nothing of any mention there, but 62, again at the US, of course, where it all comes to fruition. And I don't know if it's the same officials involved here, but again, another hasty running around trying to organise something at the last minute to commemorate Labor's win.
Yeah, I heard about this one. Was it something about Beppe Merlo, the Italian player Beppe Merlo?
Yeah, a very well-regarded Italian tennis player who is still almost legendary in various parts of Rome.
Well, yes, Beppe I knew very, very well. What a lovely gentleman he was from Italy. I studied his place many times, and just a lovely, lovely man, but I was quite appalled in 62 because when Rod won that Grand Slam, a cake was wheeled out onto the court.
Right.
And somehow they had convinced Beppe to jump out from the cake.
Okay, so we're talking like a 3 or 4 tier cake. We're not talking about some small cake presented on a plate. We're talking about something quite large here.
Quite large, but ridiculous. It didn't look like a cake. It just looked like something that somebody was inside, really. And then Beppe jumps out. I thought, oh, Beppe, no, please, no. And there's Don Budge at the side, and he I think he was having flashbacks of Bill Tilden again. And after,
yeah, but hang on. You've got Don Budge in attendance, and you've got Beppe Merlo in attendance, and one of the officials decides that it's a better idea that Beppe Merlo jumps out of the cake rather than Don Budge, the first man to win the Grand Slam. What was the thinking there? There's an opportunity missed.
Well, to me, it was obvious that Don should just present the Grand Slam. But they said to Don, well, here's the cake, get in. They hadn't given him any warning. And Don said, what do you mean getting the cake? I'm not getting into that cake. You know, that's not my style at all. He was quite offended being the first Grand Slam.
Well, what a way to treat the man. What's Labor thinking here? Like, is he just scratching his chin, wondering what's going on? Like,
you think that Labor used to anything to do with Don Budge, but it wasn't. It was Beppe Merlo, wasn't it?
Well, I guess so. And remember, Labor won the Australian in 1960, the same year that Margaret Court won, and they presented her with an umbrella. So maybe, as you say, nothing would surprise him, and maybe he's thinking, well, this beats an umbrella.
So what was he? What was he doing? Was Rod aghast at this? Well, no, Rod wasn't aghast at all. He was getting quite used to this whole schmozzle, really. You've got to remember, Rod had just won the Grand Slam. His life had almost ended a couple of months earlier.
True.
Don't rule that out. I think he felt very blessed. And then when Beppe jumped out of the cake, I don't think anything could surprise him anymore. He said, well, hello, Beppe, how are you?
He was really pleased to see him.
Yeah, shook his hand and got a little bit of frosting on there and on his racket as well. But so that was 1962, and that was the celebration there. Terribly embarrassing, really. Yeah.
But surely enough was enough, Teddy, in the sense that I know it's 62, and then Rod won it in 69 and Margaret in 1970.
And even then there was no...
There was nothing.
Nothing there.
They decided, well, look, they're not appreciating cakes, and they're not appreciating cannons being shot out. And I believe, quite surprisingly, that a group of players, for some reason, in the mid-70s, decided to take matters into their own hands.
Yes, they did.
Enough is enough. And you were approached, I believe.
Well, they came to my door, this bedraggled group of men, and they invited me and said, what is it, gentlemen? And
But who are we talking here, Teddy? Are we talking about the likes of Laver, Roach, Newcomb?
Oh, goodness, so, no. Not at all. No, right. not of that. No one of that.
Right.
Of that ilk. You're talking fine gentlemen, but I mean Herbie Flam, Harold Solomon, Tom Ocker. Who else? Oh, there was Hank Pfister, who was their most unfortunate name. Fritz Buning and Johnny Marks. And Johnny Marks was there as well. And
right.
They came in and they.
So we're talking some heavyweights.
So they just rolled up to your door, Teddy. They just came in. Well, yes, they just rolled up. And there they were. I had to invite them in. And they are sitting on the couch. I had to go and make them some tea. And they're just sitting there looking.
What do these men want with me?
A little uncomfortably. And I thought, well, yes, gentlemen, what can I do? Is this a social call? I didn't think they got around in a group. They weren't like the tennis rat pack. They had an idea. They knew how I felt about the trophy for the Grand Slam. And they had an idea. And, and they knew I was
a designer.
I designed some clothes for some of them over the years.
Right.
They didn't have the frame to wear it very well. I've got to say, they weren't clothes horses.
Teddy, some of the outfits that you designed for Johnny Marks, beautiful outfits, but I'm sorry, when Johnny had those on, I felt for you. That Terry Towling hat, he wore it at the wrong angle totally and ruined it.
Well, there's one thing to see a Terry Towling hat on the catwalk in Paris, but when you see it on the head of Johnny Marks, well, that's when fashion dies. So what was their grand question? What were they after? They're after a design for a trophy for the Grand Slam. Now, I thought it was very ironic. These men sitting in front of me, each of them had about as much chance to win the Grand Slam as Marty Feldman. I didn't say that, of course. I looked them one after the other and I thought, well, yes, Marty, who I was good friends with, a lovely gentleman.
Well, and in a certain light, Herbie Flam did look a little like Marty Feldman.
He actually acted as his double in some movies, Young Frankenstein in particular.
I'll never forget my old dad. When these things would happen to him, the things he'd say to me.
What did he say?
What the hell are you doing in the bathroom day and night? Why don't you get out of there? Give someone else a chance.
So did you design a trophy? What did you come up with?
What was the idea?
In short, no, I didn't design a trophy.
Right.
I designed a concept for them.
Okay.
That was larger. Well, then their small brains could handle, I think. Not to be disrespectful, they're fine gentlemen, I won't hear a word against them.
But they would have come to you and said, look, Teddy, all we need is a cup of some sort, something like that. You thought a little bit outside.
Well, why would they come to me for that? I'm not a cup man. I have bigger fish to fry. And if they'd seen anything that I designed, they would know that. And they had, and this is what broke my heart about the whole thing. So they asked me, and I said, gentlemen, come back in 2 days' time. That's all I'm going to need to come up with this grand concept. And so 2 days later, my doorbell rings. I opened the door, and it was always a shock to see the bunch of them together. It was really not something you want to see at your door. I had to stop from flinching.
Were they still in their tennis gear, or were they dressed in civvies? Like, how did they present?
It was the 70s, and they were dressed in their open collared shirts and their medallions and whatever. It was, and their chest hair, which I could have mown like a lawn. All of them, but they came in and they looked a little more comfortable this time, and they were very, very eager.
Oh, right.
Very eager to hear what I had to say. So I sat them down and I showed them the prototypes.
Right.
Blueprints, if you will.
Right.
Now, my idea was to have something like a Mount Rushmore in a miniature form.
Okay.
Where the heads of each Grand Slam winner was engraved, sculpted.
Right.
And room so that any new one could be added.
So these are the heads of the winners. Wow.
Yeah, it's a very Sphinx-like thing in reality.
Right.
I had a vision that when someone won the Grand Slam, that it would be brought out.
Could you imagine that? At the beginning of every Grand Slam tournament, that makes its entrance with the five heads. We've got Budge, we've got Laver, Connolly, Graff, and caught in this sphinx-like... Are we talking gold here?
A polished brass.
Polished yes. brass, my.
With these blueprints, had you done any sort of sketches or anything? Yeah. How did you show them? Did you actually do a scale model, perhaps?
Well, I'm not a sculptor, Buzz. I think that's a great mistake. I drew as well as I could, and I'm a rather good draftsman in a fashion sense. Well, they were blown away, all of them, because I don't think they could draw a line between them. So they had a look at this idea, and they told me they were going to take it to the powers that be. They were going
to present this.
They were going to present it to the heads of all. Well, they said the major tennis associations around the world and get them together. And I thought that was a wonderful, wonderful gesture. Mm-hmm. And then I heard nothing more from any of them until this day. I don't know if they thought what I did was disrespectful or perhaps not up to par or perhaps they were thrown out on their ear.
Well, you don't know, do you? You don't know once the door closed.
But I do know...
What happened to the cup?
I do know that on eBay, I saw a couple of years ago, those sketches were being sold for quite a pretty penny.
Right.
I was told this. I didn't see, obviously. I'm not that technologically savvy, but I was told they were being sold for a pretty penny. And
So they're out there. They're still out there. If you're listening, Tennis Federation, or the International Tennis Federation... They could perhaps run with this.
Maybe the time has...
It's passed.
...come and gone for that idea. But what an idea it was, Teddy. My God. Imagine that. Incredible. And I think that would be better than a trophy.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a trophy, but it'd be better than a trophy, don't you think?
It's bigger than a trophy. They say it's conceptual.
And have you done any work on anything since, Teddy? Was that your last idea for the Grand Slam trophy?
Something that's never left my mind, but no, I think after that experience, I gave it all away.
I don't blame you.
Yeah, and I think when they presented Steffi with that ridiculous bracelet, four diamonds, how pathetic was that?
Mm.
And this was after, obviously.
Oh, yeah, well after.
Well after. And I looked at that and thought, well, you missed a trick here, didn't you? Anyway, to this day, no trophy, no celebration, just ignominy.
When shall we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain?
When the hurly-burly's done, when the battle's lost and won.
That will be ere the set of sun.
Where the place?
Upon the heath,
there to meet with.
So what you were just listening to, that was Martina Navratilova, Steffi Graf, and no, not really at all, was it, Remo?
No, I think it was The Witches of Macbeth.
And the reason we're looking at witches is because of strange alchemy, Remo. Strange alchemy.
Yeah. You know, Buzz, one of the things that brings me great pleasure when I'm researching for this podcast, and I know a lot of people out there would find it hard to believe that we actually do research for this podcast, but we do, is just trawling through the facts and the figures and then coming up with a discovery. Something reveals itself to you. Do you know those moments?
Absolutely.
They're all there in front of you. Then all the pieces almost lift up off the screen.
Well, there are some that are just stats that you go, well, that's interesting. But then there is strange geometry that happens.
Connections. So as I was doing the research on this podcast, I got hit by one of these revelatory moments, if I can call it that. Now, follow me on this thread here.
I'm here.
Okay. Don Budge wins the Grand Slam in 1938. Now, this is the same year that Rod Laver is born. Now, in 1969, Rod Laver wins his second Grand Slam. That's the same year that Maureen Connolly, the first woman and the second person to win the Grand Slam, dies. And it's the same year that Steffi Graf is born. Steffi Graf is the last person to win the Grand Slam in 1988, and this is 50 years after Don Budge does it for the first time in 1938.
Wow.
Now, there's something going on there.
There's a lot of angles and repetitions and cycles going on here, isn't there?
Most definitely, and it got me thinking. We're talking about something very special here with the Grand Slam, and it's something that... I said earlier, you can't plan for the Grand Slam. It has to happen, and it happens when it's good and ready.
Yep.
It's almost like it happens of its own volition. It's almost like there's a set energy pattern that needs to be in place. Stars need to align. And I'm wondering, my theory here is this energy something that is out there doing the rounds and it's just waiting to come back into play when the time and the moment is right?
So what could possibly be the next reverberation? Because you think about it, Steffi Graf hasn't won since 1988.
Yeah.
So that means that someone would have to be 31 years old.
Born in 1988?
Yeah.
I'm looking through the draw and that's where my money's going.
Who is it?
I can't tell you that. You can do your own work on that. We're putting some scary stuff out here, but yeah, we believe that a Grand Slam will be won in 2020. They will be 31 years old. And you know what else is a possibility? A Grand Slam will be won by a redhead.
A redhead?
Well, Don Budge was a redhead. Rod Laver was a redhead. So if Rafa Nadal suddenly starts dyeing his hair red, I'm on. I'm on, and I'm on big time.
If he starts dyeing his hair red, I'm off. I'm out of here. Now, can I just say that Rafael Nadal was born in 1986, Djokovic in 1987.
What about Roger Federer? Was he born in 1988?
No. So you're saying that Steffi Graf was born the same year that Rod Laver won his Grand Slam. Is it anything with 1970?
Now, did I say that? Did I say that Steffi Graf was born the same year? I did, didn't I?
Yeah, and she was born in 69.
And the same year that Maureen Connolly died.
Died, yeah.
Yeah, but when Connolly dies, is a spirit leaving there and has it found its way into my little baby in Germany?
I wish our listeners could see what you were doing with your hands to try and indicate that, because that was ridiculous.
Well, I used to be a go-go dancer, so sometimes these moves come out in me and I don't even know what I'm doing.
So did that happen? 1970, Margaret Court. Wins the Grand Slam. Now, who was born in 1970? Andre Agassi, I believe. He never won the Grand Slam.
No.
It's ridiculous.
This theory isn't foolproof. I've just presented...
But Andre Agassi married Steffi Graf.
So in a way, he kind of did get the Grand Slam, didn't he? He got golden slam.
Yeah.
Can you get a Grand Slam by marriage?
Sure.
It's all legal.
He's got a golden slam once removed.
We didn't put Agassi in here as a Grand Slam winner, but... By marriage, he kind of is. He
kind of is, yeah, he's got it.
Okay, seriously.
No, really interesting.
It's interesting, isn't it?
I didn't know that. It's one of those things that could almost be like a conspiracy theory on YouTube.
Totally.
Not that I ever watch those things.
No, and not that we're really, there's no real conspiracy against anyone here.
Oh, okay, how about this then?
Yeah.
Steffi Graf wins in 1988. Who presents her with the...
Don Budge.
Don Budge. Since Don Budge has passed away, no one has won the Grand Slam.
That's right.
Was the Grand Slam really Don Budge's? And after he passed away, I believe in 2001 or so?
Yeah, early 2000. Yeah, yeah. So you're saying that while he's alive,
the Grand Slam's
it's up
alive.
For grabs, but now that he's passed, it's off the table for everyone?
The energy has been closed down. The portal is closed. If someone wins it, they prove them wrong. But do you think, you really think that Serena Williams is going to lose a Roberta Vinci? There was a bit of budge in there. She was budged.
Well, I have to say, it didn't strike me the time that, Roberta Vinci came out with a red wig on. And I didn't even put two and two together.
Serena did.
And that was it. She knew it was over.
It was over.
How can I possibly beat Don Budge?
Yeah.
The man who invented the Grand Slam.
By his own.
You're right. But you know what I hope? With the Australian Open coming up, the commentators will be doing their stuff. Every time there is a loser in a first round match, why don't they just simply say... in acknowledgement of the loser, well, there goes that person's chance of winning the Grand Slam this year.
In every match.
In every first round match, and the commentator. Talk to the loser. How do you feel now that winning the Grand Slam is off the table for you? You know, the winner can say, Grand Slam is still alive for you.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that throw them? They'd be expecting to say, well, how do you think you went today?
Well, I think actually in the commentary, to take it a step further, I think after every point...
Just they step closer. Say,
yeah, step, you know, Grand Slam's still alive. Oh, that's put a dent in the Grand Slam.
Let's hope for some fresh commentary.
Now, can I just go back a step?
Yes.
Something you said before, and it didn't really sink in, you talked about redheads, right?
Yeah, Laver and Budge.
Laver and Budge, the only two men to win a Grand Slam were redheads.
Correct.
Steffi Graf isn't.
No.
Nor is Court, nor is Connolly. But those two men would. It means you have to be a redhead. Andy Murray, was he a redhead?
I made a comment about Nadal dyeing his hair red for that reason.
But had you said about Laver and Budge being redheads?
Yeah, that prefaced the comment on Nadal. I didn't just come out with a red thing on Nadal because I thought, oh, wouldn't it be funny to say that Nadal's going to dye his hair red
I think what I might do from here on into the end of the podcast, which is imminent,
yeah,
is just start bringing up previous things and getting you to
just explain them again. Yeah, I think it'd be fascinating.
We might be here for another hour.
Look, at the end of the day, and we've got to get out of here, okay?
Yeah, I certainly do.
Teddy left.
Teddy's gone.
Hours ago.
Yeah.
All I'm going to say is, come the end of this year, Buzz, will I be singing, "The year is 2020, and it's a very good year."
Somebody shoot me.
Yes, it's a very good year for...
Oh, man.